We do, but we don't have a script. No script? We're going to. Oh, no, we have information, transportation funding carrying over. Is that what we're going to do first? Okay, let's do that. House Committee on Revenue for February 12th, 2015 will come to order. Thank you, colleagues, for being here on time. Appreciate it very much. We're going to continue with the information meeting that we started, or that we actually didn't start. We're carrying it forward from last week. So we'll open the information meeting for transportation funding. Please.
Afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, and to remind you and myself, Mazen Malik with Legislative Revenue Office. And today we'll have to go through a quick presentation, PowerPoint presentation on transportation funding. This would be a different presentation if it was like 10, 15 years ago. I would have started all of this presentation with highway funding and highway this, and the highway will do, and we need to have all their funding on that sense. But nowadays, things are a little different. Transportation has started having a little more diversity, if you will, in the modes and what is transportation defined and what is not. But in doing so, we will still talk about the transportation system and try to identify what the system and how it works, who controls these segments, how it is financed, who pays, and what kind of few history type of background on funding packages, and then special interest topics later on. I'm going to try to make all of these on each slide. I try to keep it for myself that each slide should have only 5 bullet points. If it's more than 5 bullet points, it should go to the planning section, not the economics section. We've managed that in the first slide point. So let's see if we can do this and continue doing it later on. So the Oregon transportation system, in general, you would have, let's keep it at 5. The highway system, road and network, public transit system and its network, the rail system and the passenger freight, aviation, and marine transportation. So we're not going to go into detail on each one of those systems, but in general, system ownership and operation, you have truly a conglomerate of different ways of who owns the system. This is both public and private ownership for these different segments of the system. A lot of it is state-owned, state-operated. Then you have a lot of it also is local, as cities and counties get into the act. And then you have transportation agencies. Those are independent transportation agencies. And, of course, local districts. These are local districts of transportation. Some of them are taxing districts, and some of them are not taxing districts, but they do operate as a transportation district. So a quick going away from the ownership of the system, if you look at the and let me start with aviation here. If you look at the aviation system, we'll look at it in different ways. But first, let's take the most obvious. We have the Oregon Aviation Department. Oregon Aviation Department, I want to give you a quick revenue sources that it depends on. It depends primarily on fuel taxes. These are both for what's so-called avgas, and this is at 9 cents per gallon, and you have jet fuel at 1 cent per gallon. So these give you, in general, about $2 million in total. That's 1.6 for the jet fuel, F-gas, 289. Jet fuel is basically the ones that are very, you know, big jets and so on. The F-gas is for a lot smaller. It's very refined gasoline, if you will. And then you have a lot of people who have airplanes that actually go and use high-grade gasoline and use that. And then that amount applied to a refund will give you the more gas. This is where the amounts of money go to the Department of Aviation. Other aviation revenues are pilots, registration, plane registration, and others, and so on. But a lot of the funds and the money that comes to the Department of Aviation truly comes from federal funds. It is lion's share of what they receive every year, about, you know, $2.25 million. Now, the state operates about 28 airports, and there are other, many other airports that are local and private. So if you look at the what we call other aviation is actually the bigger pieces of aviation. And the bigger pieces of aviation is a place like known as PDX or Portland International Airport. Portland National Airport is of course operated and owned by the Port of Portland, and this is a municipal corporation. And although it runs 15 million passengers a year, the Port of Portland also operates Troutdale and Hillsborough airports. And they, in general, have the MC, stands for Municipal Corporation. They get in about $250 million in charges per year. And those charges are just charges for use by customers. And then port itself gets about $10 million in property tax, so it has the ability to get property and receive property tax. And then you have $36.5 million coming from used charges. Used charges is the things that you would pay if you buy a ticket. There is, you know, passenger fees and so on. Other money comes about $33.5 million. So in total, the revenue comes to an entity like the port would be about $335 million a year. So if you want to look at how these revenues come in for the aviation, aviation revenue, you would, and this is the Department of Aviation, you would be looking at a picture like this, fiscal year 08, when you have an influx of federal revenue, and 10 when you actually have, a lot less federal revenue coming in. So the second mode of transportation that is probably one of the biggest ones that you want to talk about, the public transit and the public transit revenues. Most of public transit is not operated by the state. You have local districts and counties, about 40 providers. However, you have the eight big ones, local transit districts. Those, and you have also rural transit districts, the cities and the tribal governments. The big three being TriMet, Lane Transit, and Salem, operate about 90% of all transit operation and transit trips in the state. Most of the resources that come to public transit come from either ODOT I will go through the ODOT sources that you come, and you have some of them payroll taxes, you have property taxes, fares, these are the box fares that they actually collect. A lot of the money also come from the federal government, either the FTA, Federal Transit Administration, or through the flex funds from the highway or the Federal Highway Administration. A lot of the money also comes from either bonding or lottery bonds. So just to give you a flavor, TriMet is one of two agencies that actually could collect taxes on payroll. And TriMet collects about $260 million in payroll taxes. They also collect about $112 from the box fares. They have they expect about $300 million from state funds and federal funds. Total budget, operation budget of about $500 million. And if you put operation and investment or capital budget, you're talking about $700 million of annual budget. That's the biggest that you have in Oregon. And then you would look at the Lane Transit District, which has the same type of ability to collect the payroll taxes, but you see that their collection is about $27 million. And with a $7 million in box fares, revenue, $12 million. So a total about $46 or $50 million. That's about one-tenth of what TriMet is. So the size is Salem Transit does not collect on the payroll, but they have the authority to collect property taxes, and they do about $10 million of those. And then they have the fares and the state and federal funds, about $35 million in size. So the public transit division, that's an ODOT division, that gets a lot of the money through different sources and basically distributes all these monies to the different agencies that we've talked about previously. But these come from very defined sources. So you have a dedicated source of about 2 cents of your cigarette tax that comes through ODOT. That's about $7 million. You have also the ID money, some of the identification cards. You have charges for them, and those are for the either very young or very old, and they don't have driver licenses. This money is not highway fund restricted money, and what it is allowed to be used into different uses, and this is one of the uses that it is going for. It's about $4 million. You have non-highway fuels. This is what they talk about, the lawnmower fund. These are the lawnmowers and the chip, and the blowers and stuff that... So they come into good use, basically. They might be a little polluting, but they come to good use in the public transit.
The point is it's funds that are collected through the various mechanisms that ODOT uses, but are not required constitutionally to be spent on the highways.
That is correct, not restricted by the constitutional dedication. And, of course, you have the there was a provision in House Bill 2001 to transfer some money to long-term planning, but primarily transportation transit division, and a lot of federal money. So you have this is what's so-called the Special Transportation Fund, and the Special Transportation Fund is divided between the 33 counties and districts and tribal governments, and it is for the elderly and disabled, and it allows them to use transportation back and forth. So,
and of course, if you talk to the big transit agencies, they will tell you that it actually only pays a small fraction of their actual dollar ride costs
that they spend on this activity.
On this activity, right?
So
they're spending money from their fixed route funds in order to manage this federal requirement.
Yes, and of course, I mean, if we are to be fair with all modes, we probably spend a whole whole committee hearing time on each one of them. But probably we're going very, very fast, and some of it might be not as fair to these different issues and different programs as it is. But I have here a table that gives you an idea about how a lot of the federal funds come in, and they come through the division. Some of it is for ODOT to work with and transfer, and some actually go directly to the providers. So you have this line here, this column, that actually shows how much federal funds transfer directly to the providers without even having a state intervention in the process. Now, the Transit Division is about $90 million a biennium that, as I said, again, mostly distributions to different modes. Now, finally, just to go through the rest of the modes that you have rail and computer, rail and commuter, not computer. Rail, but that's what they
do on the train.
Yeah, yeah. And you have those rail lines mostly privately owned. It's public funding are primarily centered around the issue of improving crossing, railroad crossing, and so on for the safety. So it's a safety type of state or public funds. And you also have the short commuter rail that gets or got some lottery funds at certain times. And then, of course, through the Connect Oregon program, you had a lot of the funding for different modes. And I left here a website that shows the different, if you are interested in which projects were funded by the different programs of the Connect Oregon. And I'll talk about Connect Oregon in a minute. But you finally have also in different ways, you have marine ports, about 23 of those. And these are financed primarily by fees, leases, taxes, federal. Now remember these marines, marine ports and ports in general, and channels as the navigation channels are the purview of the federal government. However, in the last few years, the state did allocate some lottery bonds and funding for the deepening of the Columbia and Coos Bay channels. You have also a bike and ped program that gets about 1% of the highway fund. And you have also local funds, lottery, and federal going to that program. Connect Oregon, there was five of those, and unfortunately the third here didn't get the third line, but it's 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. And it started in 2005, or the 5 session, 7, 9, 11, and 13 session. And it was for a biennium, and their lottery bonds, the first three got $100 million each. The last two, about $40 million, and those are all lottery bonds. And those lottery bonds primarily were, the last two were subject to the reduced capacity of lottery bonds, so they only went with a $40 million each. And these projects are primarily aviation, marine, and transit. None of them go to highways.
I have a question.
Representative
Whitsitt. The ones that are funded by lottery bonds, that's not a constitutional funding or anything, designation, right? I mean, it's not something that we do every biennium. Or is it? I'm a question mark.
Representative Whitsitt, those are part of they go with the lottery bonds or lottery allowable expenditure as a economic development, and therefore they're not highway constitutionally restricted, but the lottery amounts are restricted to certain uses. This is an economic development type of use,
and they're done by law through bills that come from the Ways and Means Committee.
Okay.
After they've been considered by the Capital Construction Subcommittee, and probably the Transportation Subcommittee. It just so happened that we've done one every long session for a while. Yeah, but it's not a.
Okay.
We don't have to do it.
Right.
It's just done by law. Yeah.
Right. And now, since we're done with the, I'm sure some people would not like the way I say small modes. Now we'll talk about the 80,000 pound truck type of transportation, is highways. So the highway funding, I'm going to take slightly more time with the highway funding to talk, because highway funding seems to have developed with time, and it became type of not only a program that exists, but it has, you know, its own quirks, principles, and so on. So we will talk on how does Oregon fund highways? What is the highway fund? Is it a bank account or is it a system, and how that relates to each other? Different revenue sources, distributions of the uses of the highway fund, and then the other constitutional requirements.
Okay.
I know there was a lot of questions about the bonding programs of OTIA 1, 2, and 3. We'll talk quickly about those. And then House Bill 2001 of the 2009 session, that's also known as the Jobs and Transportation Act, JTA. So with highways, we always talk about the main idea is how in principle, in theory, in economic theory, if you will, how should roads be financed? And that comes on general financing principles of highways, because highways seem to have developed this identity that they're not like other public sort of services. You're not raising taxes in one place of the income stream and spending it for a different purpose. You're in a way raising the amounts and the revenue of the tax and spending it for the users. So it's becoming more of a user fee type of thing. And because it is a user fee type of thing, it goes with different type of principles. So one of them is the first, we would say, equity. And equity in that sense is not necessarily only ability to pay and benefits received, but the equity is in a way of the principle of equity is that users should pay in proportion to the cost they impose. And that basically gives you two elements, the users and the costs. And the users have different classes of use. And the costs here are the planned expenditure and construction operation, but primarily comes to a two type of costs, what we call the fixed cost, which is the big projects, the big bridge, the highway, the well-settled starting cost, and then the your marginal cost. This is the damage to the system that happens every day and every year by the repeated use. So, and then, of course, there are things that we call external costs that we might or might not get that cost charge, which is the congestion costs and pollution costs. So if we're looking at treating this in an equal way, that's the type of things that we should be looking for, the financing of highways. And then you have the principle of economic neutrality, in the sense is you don't need to end up with winners or losers because of what highway you built. So cars versus trucks, multimodal, intensity of use, all of these things, you allow for economic neutrality by not giving preference to one user versus the other. And then you have...
Excuse me just a moment. Representative Vance?
So the concept of spreading our transportation dollars across Oregon like peanut butter, that would be a neutral approach. But not necessarily what you mean by economic neutrality. So if we wanted to do what we used to do, which was to invest heavily in areas where the highest economic activity occurs so that you can drive the greatest return on investment, is that economically neutral? I ask because, of course, our history over the United States has been a trend away from loading up in the areas where you have the greatest ROI and instead spreading the political cost and benefit out across your entire state.
Right.
And the result is a dramatic reduction in return on investment. So I need to know where that principle fits in that debate.
Well, it fits. Not very well, but it fits.
Apparently,
the economic neutrality is. I think what you're asking, Representative Benz, is on economic efficiency, and economic efficiency is having or economic effectiveness. The effectiveness is: are we building the right type of facilities? Meaning, is it effective where we're spending our money and allowing for that investment to be as effective as possible? I think the economic effectiveness is slightly different than economic neutrality. And a lot would probably say we are not being as effective economically as we should be with our expenditures. So that is probably one of the weaknesses of our system. Versus the other strength of our system.
Representative,
I think these elements, equity, economic neutrality, cost efficient, the source of those, is that constitutional? I know there's an equity principle in our Constitution,
right.
But the neutrality piece, where does that come from?
The neutrality piece comes from theory, and basically what I would, my thesis would be there is a transportation economic theory. And I'm going to prove to you that the system here in Oregon has been brilliantly built by the legislature and the to the point that it actually conforms well with economic theory and principles.
I'm looking forward to that.
All right.
Question.
Oh, yes, Representative Johnson. Please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you back up a little bit and just regarding that comment about pollution costs, how do you define that, and what role, if any, does that play in the financing of roads? How does a department determine a pollution cost and how it might allocate funds or resources based on that principle?
Representative Johnson, I think this is still in the realm of theory. Congestion, of course, happens, cost, and you could quantify it. Pollution cost could be. Whether we mitigate it or not, that's a different exercise that comes later on in the presentation. How do we expend our money? Do we address these issues all together or not? And pollution costs are probably... not all addressed in expenditures. Some are, like the water mitigation of pollution and so on, but not all pollution that occurs or pollution costs are retrieved through the payer system. So if you have a cost and you have somebody that's causing the cost, is the user paying for that cost that they're causing to the system? And it's not all of the costs are being charged equally.
And is this driven by policy or statute, or is this an internal mechanism that you're
well,
relying upon?
Again, this is probably driven by theory and best what it should be.
Mm-hmm.
And later on, just in few slides, I would probably show or hope to show that we have built a very good system that recovers a lot of the costs, but not all the costs.
Okay. Look forward to that. Thank you.
Yeah. You're talking, many of these costs are externalized costs now, aren't they?
Right. They're the external costs.
Congestion costs are paid by people who are sitting in traffic because they can't get to work or home on time.
Right.
Pollution costs are paid by everybody.
Right.
Even if they don't generate any pollution.
That's correct.
Yeah.
That's correct. And just to go with the, you know, the cost efficiency that we talked about, there is economic efficiency also. And I would argue that we probably have all elements within our system to pay for a lot of things, but economic efficiency is not one of them. Because if you think about a system on a market in any kind of theory, market is elements of how you interact between supply and demand. And if mobility is the commodity, and then you have the right price set for that commodity, you have the price equates between supply and demand, and the market will clear. So you will not have a congestion problem, because the market congestion is a breakdown in mobility markets for at least a while. So in that sense, we don't have all of that paid for. So obviously, our price that we're charging when it comes to economic efficiency in the sense of congestion is not the right price at that time.
Yeah, and other places, of course, have tried to figure out ways
to actually price
congestion. I think of London and its restriction on cars coming in without paying a fee. Just for being there, and other places that actually charge a different rate to cross a bridge during certain times of the day because of congestion, those kinds of things.
That
we don't
correct.
Do any of those now.
That is correct.
We?
Mr. Chair, one thing I have to also bring back to you, that in House Bill 2001, I mean, it's not necessarily completely ignored by the legislature. You have mandated a congestion study and an efficient fee study. So we've been looking at all these things, because you've put it in different legislation, you and of course your predecessors, and we are looking into these issues, because we although we are not addressing them immediately at this point, but we are researching and trying to see how we resolve these issues. So again, to go to the now in Oregon, let's see if those we've just talked about is the general idea of how highway economics should work. Let's see how if Oregon has a system of how we finance that. And the system that we have in Oregon says those who use the roads should pay for them. And I'll show you this citation from the Constitution and law in few slides. Then the road user fees should be used for only construction, improving, and maintaining the roads. So that's a constitutional dedication. And then that you have road users should pay in proportion to the road costs which they exact and they are responsible for. So that's the thesis, basically, of what you have in the Oregon Highway Finance. And let's go from this point on to show how that worked. So just we can't do this without going through a quick history of how the Oregon road user taxes became. In 1899, we had the first car come to Oregon. And if Ozzy Rose was here, he would say he owned that car. But the 1905 was the first statewide registration fee. It was $3 one time. It was almost like a property tax. In 1912, then you have property assist. And, of course, in 1919, this you hear that date all the time, is that first gas tax in the nation. That was started in Oregon at 1 cent per gallon. And then in 21, you had the first increase. In 1925.
2 years later, right?
in 25, you had the first ton mile tax enacted. And I know you've heard of the weight mile tax. The ton mile tax are not exactly as the weight mile tax, they're close. Ton mile tax is probably more exact, because it is by the mile and the weight rather than the gross vehicle weight and the mile. So,
230.
Then you have the 1947 is when the weight mile tax comes in, And then 49, the gas tax goes to 6 cents, and by the way, it stays at 6 cents for a very, very long time. In 51, you have the 8 mile increased, referred to the voters, constitutional amendments. And then in 67, the gas tax goes to 7 cents. Remember, that's from the 50s. Then in 83...
Let me just break in for a second. Yes, I don't want to rush you, but our meeting is going to be 15 minutes shorter today than usual in order to accommodate a caucus meeting at 2:30. So if we can be finished in another 10 minutes or so, that would be really helpful. And if we can't, we'll finish it another day.
Okay. We'll shoot for that, Mr. Chair. Then probably we can... go for basically these are the OTIA programs that came through this history. OTIA changed your vehicle registration, and also it has the bridge program in 2003. That's OTIA 3. The House Bill 2001 did a lot of things, but primarily wanted to raise $300 million. Per year, and it did all these other changes. And the one thing that OTIA did that have not been done before is it primarily picked which projects are to be financed through the bonding process. This was new in the Oregon way of doing things, but it was connected to the bonding. So a quick thing, we're going back to the what is the highway fund issue and how it is a constitutional dedication and how it relates to the system design and the legal definition and other uses of the terms and so on. So the constitutional dedication says basically if you have anything that is for the main, you collect, it's for the maintenance, operation, and construction. And that is basically covering anything that you use for the propulsion of the motor vehicles, meaning any source of energy, and or things that you have on the operation and use of the motor vehicles. Then you would have what you could spend it on. Also, in addition to that, the provisions on the top is you have the administration and you have refunds. You could do bonds. And, of course, you have this provision that you allow for parks to take their park type of fees. Then, if you look at all of these, you're primarily looking at what the Oregon user road taxation does. So you have the fuel tax and the used fuel tax. These are the two pieces of the tax. You have the weight mile tax, that's both table A and B. And then you have flat fees and road use assessment. And you have vehicle registration fees, both light and heavy. And you have title fees and other fees. So, and then finally you have an operation piece that comes. So that the pieces of the puzzle put together look in a way this way.
I have a question.
Now,
Representative Whitsitt, please.
I don't know if I missed this or not, but what does each 1 cent of gas or fuel tax equal in revenue to the state at the present time?
Well, at the present time, if you look at that, it's about just the fuel by itself, about $16 million or so.
1 cent.
Yes.
Okay.
That's not without its weight mile equivalent, of course.
Great. Okay, thank you.
Now, if we look at the legal definition of, this is the only place, by the way, that you have a definition, what's so-called the state highway fund, is in the statutes. And if you look at the legal definition of the highway fund and what the sources of those are coming to, you will be looking at a puzzle that looks that way, which is slightly different than what the constitutional dedication was. Now, if you look at what legal definition of the funds to be distributed between states, cities, and counties, there are many in the statutes, but some of them, like that, this is the one about the Otilla one. This is where it takes $71 million and puts them in bonds and then distributes the rest to cities and counties. That puzzle looks even a little more different than that. But in general, the city and county distributions have different programs, different amounts, and those different amounts come to a different percentages. Maybe one of these days we will make it only one percentage, but that's a different program. So again, remember that we talked about the fixed cost and the variable cost, and in a way we look at vehicle registration fee as a fixed cost that pays for the fixed cost, because it's one pay one time, and whether you use roads five times a day or five times a year, you'll still pay the same thing. And this is at about $86 after House Bill 2001, and those are all fixed costs. The new thing with House Bill 2001 is also that you have the ability of the county to counties larger than a certain amount of population to levy registration fees. Those are now only Multnomah County does that. The new thing that we use also since OTIA 1, 2, and 3 is the title fees. Title fees, we used to think of them in the past and in the system, if you will, as ownership fees. And ownership fees are not either fixed costs or a variable cost. They're just a piece of ownership. But they became now also part of the new fixed cost component. So because they are in the same time, although they're only one time, they are becoming the new fixed cost component. They, in OTIA 1, they went to 55 and 90 and so on. The variable costs are the fuel tax, basically because the more you use, the more you pay. And local gas taxes, then you have the other things. Here's what you, thing that looks at different increases in the gas tax in historical terms. Remember, this period of time, there was no increase at all at 7 cents. You had it all the way until 1980, 81, and then you had a quick increase. Not all of these were tax votes or packages. Some of them, like in the late 80s, had a package of what the so-called 2 plus 2 plus 2, where you had only one time, and then every year the gas tax goes by 2%, 2 cents automatically. And then it stayed for 24 cents for a long time until you had the JTA that pushed it to 30 cents. Now, if you put these things in different indices of what is real terms, this is in 2011 dollars, because that's the time of the GTA, you would find that you know, there are times when you had it a lot higher. Of course, sometimes this is important for some people to see and might or might not be the, you know, the best way of looking at it. Really, in $82, it looks that way, and it's at 11 cents. This is how fuel tax collection go. And if you could see how the increases here happened, and then the recession kind of took a bite out of this, and then you started after the House Bill 2001 going up again. So and this is in million of dollars. You're talking about nowadays about $477 million. So this is an interesting chart that I've put together from the EPA site. And if this makes any sense, in this axis you would have the miles per gallon, and that the other axis you have the horsepower of vehicles, okay? So at certain times in the 1975 on, you had this new coming of the CAFA standards and so on. And there was an emphasis on increasing miles per gallon with time. And this is, you remember, I don't know, the Pinto and the Gremlin and...
Well, that was a classic.
I'm sorry, and the Vega. Those were...
Some of us had forgotten about that one.
I yes. I'm dating myself here, I guess, right? So there was an obsession with increasing miles per gallon. And however, if you remember, they were so underpowered. And there comes also even the small vehicles that are coming from the Japanese vehicles and so on. And that kept actually, but it gained in miles per gallon with time. And you would see that by the 82, 83, you have increased all the new vehicles coming out of the... and this is a combination between light vehicles, meaning cars, light trucks, and it is both highway and city. And then you would see a great ascendance in horsepower. This has to do also with the ascendance of the SUVs, if you will. They remember how the SUVs became and the trucks became very popular in the vehicle market, and it became more horsepower. Even though doing so did not really lose a lot of the mile per gallon type of component, which meant, you know, you're actually getting a lot. An improvement in both, but slightly losing miles per gallon, but not much. And then comes this time when you started actually having an increase in both. And so you have an increase in horsepower still, and you're still also slightly going in that direction when it comes to miles per gallon. Now, where is that going to go? This way, this way, or that way? I mean, that's a whole different ball game. Do we know? Do we have a prediction? Maybe, but we don't have a grasp on it. This will primarily decide how much you would look at reduction in gas taxes or gas consumption or not. But obviously, the trend is going into a direction that needs to make us pay attention and see when it is going to start coming down. We don't, the official state forecast does not see it coming down yet, but we don't have a year yet that we see we are going to start turning down in that time. But this is the EPA estimates, and it might not look like it, but it took a lot of work to get this done.
we certainly believe that.
Yes.
Yeah, Representative Johnson.
Thanks, Chair. Well, I think, you know, there are some policies or rules in place that you know are going to only increase efficiencies. You know, the federal CAFE standards are projected to be close to, 50 miles per gallon at some point in time. So, obviously, that will have an impact. Do you have data or can you compile data that can look at per capita consumption of fuel by Oregonians and how that has, let's say, over the past 15 years, you know,
yes,
how many gallons per person were we on average consuming in 85 or something, and what are we consumed up to the latest? Because I think that's a very informational piece of information.
We, Representative Johnson, we can do that. I could also superimpose MPGs.
That'd be
on
perfect.
horsepower.
Could I look at it before lunch?
No, well, before lunch tomorrow, maybe.
I think that would be a really good idea. It gives us a sense of where we're going. And, of course, I'll make my own prediction, and that is that in addition to the CAFE standards, it will be very difficult to buy a gasoline-powered car 20 years from now because of the prevalence of electric vehicles and the dearth of gas stations. That's a prediction that I'm making. It's not one that anyone else in an official position is who actually understands transportation is making. But that is going to happen, and of course, as that is happening, we're going to have to come up with a new way of funding highways. Right now, it's the gas tax and the weight mile tax. Later, it'll be something else. Who knows exactly what? You're about to move on to the Oregon road user taxation, weight mile taxes, and because of the time today, We're going to continue in that with that conversation next week.
Okay.
At a time that we haven't yet figured out, because we want to get through the rest of our agenda in time for that caucus meeting at 2:30. So thank you very much. Colleagues, I would commend to you the material that he's already covered. He went through some of it pretty fast. And please feel free to review those slides. And if you have any questions, Mazin's available to answer them. This is a fairly complex piece, and of course it's really important that we understand it well so that we can deal with the problems of maintaining our road and repairing and replacing bridges and the like. Thank you very much. And with that, we're going to close the information meeting on transportation funding and open a work session on the introduction of committee bills. Vice Chair Bentz, please.
Mr. Chair, I move LC 3441 dated 2/11/15 and LC 3446 dated 2/12/15 be introduced as committee bills.
Thank you. Representative Bentz moves LC 3441 and LC 3446 to be introduced as committee bills. The usual proviso applies. We're not introducing these bills because anybody agrees with them or doesn't agree with them. They're simply a way of getting the bills before the House. Is there any discussion? Any objection to the motion? Hearing none, it's so ordered. Close the work session on introduction of committee bills. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2154, 2155, and 2218. Paul?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. These three bills, what we have been doing and working on the schedule with the chair and the vice chair is grouping bills into categories. If you've looked at the list, we've got quite a few of them in committee. So one of the themes that emerges in that sorting process is this a series of bills around economic development incentives, analysis. I call them economic development incentive and analysis and report bills. There is a one-page summary of the three bills that the chair just opened the public hearing on. So you can see those summarized in that on that one sheet, and you'll quickly notice what the theme is.
What's that called?
I don't think it's posted.
No.
It's under the bill. If you click on
under the bill itself,
any of the three bills, you'll get the same thing.
Okay, great. Thank you.
They're all the same.
Right.
All three of the bills are summarized on that one page. House Bill 2154 directs the Oregon Business Development Department to implement a program audit function on tax expenditures related to economic development. And this is the one bill in the group that does specifically make statutory references. And I've put those on that summary sheet. You can see there a number of them are veterans of this committee or very familiar with. Number of the tax credits we've worked with over time, the film and video production credit, e-commerce enterprise zone. There is also a reference to what we've called the MANI, which is the manufacturing facilities credit for resource renewable equipment. That, of course, did sunset at the end of last year, the end of 2013. So that one's not currently on the books, although there are some proposals to bring that back. In fact, we have a bill next week that proposes to do that. So that gives you kind of a sense. And the numbers I listed there for you are the numbers that are for the tax expenditure report. So that's where those come from. So we wanted to kind of cross-reference those. The bill itself specifies that those audits be conducted and that the interim committee, the department is to prepare this report and for the interim committee's legislative assembly related to revenue and make the report available publicly. So that would require Business Oregon to do that. We did ask them to be here, and they're here to address it kind of from a general perspective. House Bill 2155 directs the Department of Revenue to prepare a report for interim revenue committees. And the report is to include the use of tax expenditures for purposes connected to economic development by business size category, which is not something we directly do at this point. It further specifies reports to include recommendations allocating the availability of tax expenditures in this manner. These, again, the theme is analysis and reporting of economic development related tax expenditures, not just credits, but tax expenditures. And finally, 2218 is directed really at all agencies, all agencies that are responsible for either certifying or administering economic development related tax expenditures. Of course, we went through this with the Betsy, for example, the Department of Energy that was certifying those credits and going through that process and putting a lot of their time and resources into managing it. What this bill does is require that these agencies establish policies and procedures that specify and verify the objectives of the individual tax expenditure. So this is kind of part of the discussion we've had a lot in this committee. What's the purpose of the tax expenditure? What are we trying to accomplish? And that, of course, is where we look to you and to give us, you as the policymaker, to give us guidance for analysis. And then it further requires that the information be put on the transparency website and updated on an annual basis. So those are the three bills before you, Mr. Chair.
And we're going to hear from
The Business Development Department is here. Ivo Toomer is here, and Art Fish. I think you're familiar with both of them.
Yep.
They've appeared before the committee a number of times.
Great, gentlemen. I don't know. We don't have a witness sheet. Are there other people signed up? I don't know that.
They are. Yes.
Please go ahead. Thank you for coming today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ivo Trummer. I'm the Legislative Affairs Manager for the Oregon Business Development Department, or Business Oregon for short. I'm here to talk briefly about House Bill 2154. We'll limit our comments there. With me is Art Fish, the Tax Incentive Specialist for the department. As I start, maybe just briefly, Business Oregon, our mission is to grow Oregon jobs, companies, and communities. If I may indulge you briefly, you'll hear two main themes from us this session. One, we are all about rural economic development, and then innovation and startups. I want to talk about just tax incentives in general, maybe just and start maybe with the report that the Pew Center on the States did in 2012. I believe Paul Warnett made that available to you. The big conclusion of the study in 2012 is that Oregon is one of 13 states nationwide that actually lead the nation in terms of evaluating state tax incentives on both the scope of the evaluation and the quality of the evaluation. In fact, the Pew study specifically mentions 2009 legislation that established sunsets for all tax or all major tax incentives as one of the great trigger points for an ongoing evaluation of efficacy and investment and value of the investment through the tax incentives. And thank you, Dr. Warner, for already mentioning the tax expenditure report. We brought a copy of that one, too, and then also the transparency website, which we update with the required stuff on an annual basis. House Bill 2154 really requires the Oregon Business Development Department to institute program audit functions for tax incentives. I will start with the statement that we actually don't do audits ever. We get audited, if you will. Currently, we have three ongoing audits for the department. Unless it's an audit triggered by the Secretary of State on their regular schedule, we pay for audits either directly to the Secretary of State or if they don't have the capacity to private companies. So there are certain costs associated. A program audit of that sort would likely just be limited, really, to considering whether the program works as intended. Does the taxpayer get the incentive that they applied for, and how does it work? Are the rules followed and such? Last, I would say that great list that you had up there, thank you, Dr. Warner, not all that data is actually readily available to us. It's sometimes the Department of Revenue will have it and is bound by confidentiality rules and cannot release or will not release. So we don't always have access to all the data, and not all the incentives that are listed there are actually administered by us. Sometimes they're administered by locals or other entities. I think I'll pause here. If there are any questions, Mr. Fish is here to answer maybe the more technical questions, since he is really the specialist on the tax incentives.
I think it would be helpful if you went into detail in writing on the point you just made, mm-hmm. about what it is that the department has available and what it doesn't, so that we can sort that out. And if you know which departments do have that information, you might let us know that too. Rather than trying to do it in oral testimony, it might be better to have it in writing.
Oh, we can certainly provide
that
to the committee.
So we can do write amendments that would be appropriate to deal with this. And final comment about it: just because you haven't done it before doesn't mean you can't. It would be a departure, and I think it's useful for the committee to know that.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Other questions, comments? Yes, Representative Wetzel, please.
I concur with you, and it would be nice to see, like on your last slide, by credit, what return you has essentially have as a result of the credit that you've extended. What are we seeing as the end result of that in terms of revenue? So we put out this much money as a credit. What do we have back for that now? Monetarily.
We can certainly compile the data that we have and show you where we don't have the data to make that conclusion.
Right.
Mr. Chair?
Yes. Representative Smith-Warren.
I think that Representative Whitsitt is trying to get at what my sense of all three of these bills are is I think the desire is to get some sort of cost-benefit analysis. And I think you were very clear on saying if we were to audit this, all we could do is we could tell you who filed these and that they filed them. And I don't believe that's the intent of the way I read these proposals to be. So I think, not to paraphrase you, but it seems to me the underlying your statement is that you may not be the best way that just very factually, here's what we can do. So I would say as a member of this committee that we might one of the good things about grouping these bills like this is for us to figure out what is the best way to get at what I think the sense of these proposals are. And I believe our answer here today may have been it may not necessarily be through Business Oregon. And I respect, and I also get, just because you haven't done it doesn't mean you can't. And at the same time, though, we don't want to just get something that's not going to give us, I think we need to have a better sense of what specifically we're looking for. And this is a great way for us to get a sense of where can we find that. I think there is a sense of what we're looking for and where can we find that. And that's what we can kind of use this mm-hmm. back and forth to figure out.
Thank you. Thank you. Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So having been through this lots, the starting place for me always is what was the purpose everybody intended the tax credit to achieve, and that sounds easy, right? But going back and sorting out what type of behavior we were intending to incent can be a little challenging. It may not be clear what we were intending. So if you come back and give us a ROI on something that's got nothing to do with what we were intending, that's not very helpful. So exactly how you sort that out, you might want to come back and ask us. You might want to come back and say, you know, we looked at your tax credit and we can't figure out why you ever created it. And so then we could maybe direct you in designing that which we're expecting you to bring back. Because having been through this is the second full cycle of reviewing these things. Or is it third? I can't remember.
We're in the third now.
Third.
When you're having fun,
lose track. But trying to figure out what we intended is quite the challenge. Just saying, and then trying to figure out if we're achieving that. I want to emphasize this is really important because you're going to spend a whole bunch of time doing this as we have, and yes. It would be very sad if you came back with the wrong, having focused on the wrong assumed out the outcome you assumed we thought we were trying to achieve.
Yes, thank you.
If I may, Mr. Chairman, carry on a little bit more here. This,
sure.
This,
yes.
So if the outcome is to, let's say, reduce CO2, okay, it might be couched in a way that actually reduces consumption of something, or who knows. But that's the point. We would want to make sure when you came back you would say to us, hey, we understood that the intent of the tax credit was to reduce CO2, and here's our measure of how well it did. And we might say, no, the whole idea was to reduce the gasoline consumption. Okay? So I'm just saying, you might save yourself a lot of grief when you come back in with what the report is by asking first.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Benz, if I may comment, thank you for that comment. That actually opens the door for me to say it'd be easier for us to conduct studies if we actually know what we are looking for. in terms of in, Not that we want to look until we find what you might want to see, but it will give us direction.
Right.
And instead of bringing you a rock and tell us what you would like the rock to be.
That's right. Precisely why we hold public meetings, mm-hmm. to look at bills.
Yes.
So that we start with a concept that's, mm-hmm. that's roughly formed and end up with one that hopefully can be actually administered and result in something useful. Mm-hmm. So we appreciate that very much. Other questions or comments for this panel? Because we have several other witnesses to hear.
Make a comment, Mr. Chair. Just follow up on the point that Representative Vance is raising. I did notice that going through this list of specific statutes that, as you know from getting a briefing on the tax expenditure report last week, the Department of Revenue goes through and tries to lump them into kind of program areas. Most of these are in the economic development, community development area, but a number of them are in the natural resource area. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, there's where there is some, sometimes it's multiple objectives, and we've seen this, of course, in terms of the energy credits and so forth. So, I mean, it's not clear always what your primary direction is and primary concern. So I think that is really, in terms of the analysis, that's a big step to get a firm understanding of what your purpose is before we proceed.
Thank you. And I think that your comments are fair on a bill like this that needs additional definition. Thank you. Yes, Representative Davis.
Mr. Chair, just a question for you and for staff. House Bill 2155, it directs the Department of Revenue. Are we going to hear from them as well?
Representative Davis, I expected we would, but I don't see them.
Okay.
I did talk with them.
Of course, that means that they're perfectly fine.
So
with
they're
it.
Fine with it. That's right.
I mean, anybody who
I think we talked about acquiescence by omission a few.
When people don't come, we assume they're fine with the bill. Right. That's right. That's right. We may actually check in that one further.
Yes.
Anything else for this panel? Thank you, gentlemen, very much. We appreciate your sitting through the other presentation and waiting for this one.
We
have a number of people signed up for this bill. I'm going to call some of them now. I'm going to call one of them at the end because he is also signed up on the other two bills, and no one else is. So let's hear from Tim Conway, Jody Weiser, and Steve Robinson. We're on, for this purpose, we're on House Bill 2154. And do you want to begin? That would be fine.
Chairman Barnhart, committee members, my name is Tim Cowan. And just for credibility, I'm a retired senior vice president, regional manager, Mid-Valley Central and Eastern Oregon for First Interstate Bank. One of my assignments was in the special credit department, and we did things like workouts for Chrysler. Here's what my comments are about tax credits. There was a company that I read about in the Oregonian that did special type of solar panels. Mm-hmm. They received loans and financial support and tax credits. In the article, they talked about the company and that the company had received $20 million in tax credits, and the company subsequent from that sold them. And the only reason they would sell them is because they needed working capital. I wrote a subsequent article about that, but since I hadn't talked to them, I was not going to do anything unless I gave them the courtesy of finding out how much I was correct or not, just based on the article. So I gave it to the Secretary of State and asked her to review it before I would even consider publishing it. My issue is, how are you going to include tax credits in this type of a bill, and what happens when they sell them? Where does it go? In this particular case, it was with the solar panels, it was given based on employment. And so I don't know if the tax credits were sold to a company that for employment purposes. So you might want to include that in your considerations. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Robinson.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Steve Robinson. My consulting firm is Decision Metrics. Before I start talk about the bill, I'd like to just say something about Business Oregon itself and the direction that it's going. And I'm very encouraged reading their strategic plan that now emphasizes building helping local businesses, small local businesses in Oregon, as opposed to trying to recruit and get people to come here from outside. I think that they've made a lot of progress in that regard. So I support them in that effort. I'd like to encourage the Revenue Committee to work toward greater accountability and transparency regarding tax expenditures that purport to foster economic development in our state. Whether the vehicle for doing that is one of the bills before you today or some of the others in the pipeline is less important than the ultimate goal. I've been working for several years with other people who are concerned about the lack of information available to the public about the use of tax dollars to provide incentives to private businesses. I know that that we're considered among the leaders. We were considered among the leaders in the Oregon benchmarks, and it maybe just speaks to the lack of transparency and accountability available nationwide. The kind of information we're getting is considered groundbreaking in national leadership, but it still isn't enough, I think.
Thank you.
These tax incentives are funds that could otherwise be used in the general fund to reduce class sizes, provide more school days and educational enrichment programs, or reduce waiting lists for child care programs that would enable young families to work to seek and keep a better job. These business incentive programs may be working extremely well, producing tons of new jobs and helping workers get off unemployment and welfare programs. On the other hand, some of these tax expenditures may be just windfalls that enrich the business owners without providing any benefit to our economy. In many cases, we just don't know because the information is either not provided to the sponsoring agency or is kept confidential, as with the Department of Revenue, and not released to the public. We need to find a way to evaluate tax subsidies at a more detailed level than just sending a message that Oregon is friendly to business. We need data. I'm not talking about sensitive information that would be helpful to competitors. I'm talking about basic data on numbers of employees, their wages and job classifications, things like that. We need to say to private businesses, if you want the state or local government to help your business succeed by giving you a subsidy, you need to report back with enough detail to show how the program is working out for you. We're all in this together. If you're unwilling to report back because privacy is that important to you, then don't ask for public subsidies. I'd just like to comment specifically about all three bills in the interest of time rather than coming back several times. And I would like to take them in reverse order to what you've got on the agenda here. I just would characterize the motive behind 2218 as being a kind of a before the fact. Let's make sure that we know what the tax incentive is supposed to be doing. So that's kind of like setting it up for later discussion. Let's make the purpose clear. 2155 basically is talking about how are we going to figure out whether our program, our overall program of tax expenditures is working, whether it's balanced correctly. I was, as I said, encouraged by the Business Oregon's new emphasis on local businesses as opposed to big business. Oregon business versus trying to attract others. Let's focus on what's really effective and where the jobs are being created and make sure that our incentives are targeted at the right place. And then finally, 2154 is the after the fact. It's looking at each program and trying to determine whether or not that program is working to get the kind of information, to get the kind of result that we want to try to achieve. So I think there are three different focuses, whether it belongs in one bill as a programmatic kind of a thing or should be divided up, I think is less important than having a strategy around improving the way that we do tax expenditures for economic development. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ms. Weiser, please.
For the record, Jody Weiser with Tax Fairness Oregon. I agree with everything Steve said. I would be cautious. I don't think you usually ask an organization to do an audit of themselves. and they don't seem to particularly want the job. We worked with several other people in Washington County coming up with another bill that you'll see called the Taxpayer Return on Investment Act. And as we were working through that, we struggled with who should be doing audits. And it's probably the Secretary of State, but it's not the kind of audits they've necessarily been doing either. So that's really a question that needs to be worked out. And I will say that what we have now isn't always working. For instance, I was trying to see how many jobs were created in enterprise zones around the state. Now, you're supposed to have at least one new job to get tax-free benefits in an enterprise zone. And yet, in several counties, I looked and say they had five businesses in the enterprise zone. Four of them would have how many jobs they had, but one of them had nothing filled in. And it's like, well, what does that mean? Have they gone out of business? Then why are they on the list at all? They should be, that property should be back to paying taxes. Or are they being allowed to just not submit records? And that kind of follow through on transparency. Transparency alone doesn't get us any place. There has to be clawbacks. And I think the other thing is to try to figure out what kind of limits we want on how much we pay for a job. We know with the Betsy we paid $1 million for some jobs. Yeah. And that's not recoverable.
Each,
yes, yeah. Yes. It's not recoverable. And yet there are times when that's not the way to look at the incentive, perhaps, because you've got multiple goals. And if you, you know, if you look at a wind farm, well, we knew there weren't going to be very many jobs there. The question was, should we tax them on the full value of their asset or not? And we chose a middle ground that isn't particularly related to how much they're producing on their wind farm. So it's probably not a particularly sound idea. But you're not going to get, that was never really for incenting jobs particularly. That was for incenting wind energy and renewable energy. So it's going to be hard to come up. It's going to be different metrics for each thing we're trying to accomplish.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Questions for this panel? I'd simply note that you've restated the questions eloquently, and I personally appreciate that. Of course, the issues that these bills and all five of you have testified so far raise are precisely the questions that the committee and the legislature has to answer as it deals with this whole topic. Thank you very much. Let's hear from Russ Dondereau, who's signed up on all three of the bills. And Russ, while you're sitting down there, I will note that you're going to lose a big chunk of the committee in about 6 minutes.
Okay.
So if you can do it in that, I don't want to rush you, but if you can do it in that, it would be great.
Despite the fact I'm a retired college professor, I can do it.
Thank you.
My name is Russ Dondereau. I've brought before you a summary of the bill that Jody just referred to that we've been working on for the last year and a half, which is ironically, given the testimony from Business Oregon folks, is also based upon examining very carefully the Pew study. And let me start, let me make a frame this by saying I echo everything that's been said, both by the Business Oregon folks as well as by the three panelists, that what we need is transparency. But the Pew report specifically said where Oregon was most efficient was oversight. Oversight. And you as legislators know better than anybody that you can have the best program possible out there with the best intentions, but if you don't have the data in front of you during the session or during the interim to assess whether what kind of bang we're getting for the buck, you don't have the capacity to be to lead your oversight function. And as a retired political science professor who has pounded in my students for decades that Congress often fails, as does the president, on oversight, it's to me that's the key in any bill. And so what our group is looked for and what we're proposing in HB 2087 is a very robust process that incorporates many of the things that the Oregon Department of Business indicate they want to do. And so I think there's an opportunity here for a conversation with a bunch of us who've been working on this issue, and now we know we're all sort of working together. So that's number one. Number two, as the chair said, we need to have good data. And, you know, as is often the case, you know, it is said publicly as well as in legislative hearings, we are data-driven. Well, we are and we're not.
Yeah.
And the only good data is data we can trust. And you all know in the old computer era of the bygone era, there was, you know, garbage in and garbage out. And so we need to make sure the data is trustworthy. You know, trust and verify, as Ronald Reagan once said. And so I think, you know, again, our particular bill is going to be heard eventually, we hope, by the House Transportation Economic Development Committee. And we're going to members of that committee next week talking through the bill. In the sense of openness, we've talked to Chair Barnhart and we've talked to Representative Benz. And so we've been talking to folks for almost a year and a half. So we want to continue the conversation. So thank you for bringing this up, and I applaud the Department of Business for doing that too, and let's get on with it.
Thank you. Questions for Russ?
Sure.
Thank you very much. House, we don't think that 2087 has gotten to us yet, but your remarks are germane to the bills that are in front of us today, so
right.
We appreciate your testimony.
Yeah. Right. Thank you.
Anyone else would like to speak on these three bills today? Seeing no one, we will close the public hearing. And colleagues, we will see you again on Monday at 1 o'clock. Have a great weekend. With that, excuse me just
can
a moment.
Can I just say one
Paul?
Thing before I forget about scheduling next week? I wanted to point out to the committee members that the revenue forecast will be on Thursday. Oh. And because we've swapped time slots with the Senate Revenue Committee, they will be hosting the presentation Thursday morning at 8:30, and you're invited to attend and sit on the dais with the Senate Revenue Committee.
But,
in this
but
room.
That does not excuse you from our 1 o'clock meeting. We will meet at 1 o'clock on Thursday. In addition to our guest appearance with the Finance and Revenue Committee at 8:30.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you, Paul.
An hour? How long should we schedule for that?
Usually that meeting runs about an hour. Okay. They may have other business, but the part we should be there for is just the revenue estimate.
Great. Thank you.
Send out a reminder to us.
Yep. Yes. Paul will send out a reminder.
Yes.
And with that, the committee is adjourned. Thank you. Thanks a lot. I'm glad you